everyone. Welcome to another episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. I'm your host, Claire Malky. As the election inches closer and closer, I find myself having a hard time making plans for farther out than 2 weeks. It's like I check my calendar and realize the election is less than 30 days away, and I feel my blood pressure start to rise. I basically have a big red question mark scribbled throughout the calendar for the rest of 2020. Speaking of the election, welcome to the Sit Still, Look Opinionated Trump versus Biden election special. It's like our version of the presidential debates, but without all the senseless interruptions, which is definitely one of the perks of being a solo host. Heads up, no interview guests this week. We've got a lot happening in this episode, and Trump and Biden both neglected to respond to our interview inquiries. Apparently, they were too busy managing their campaigns. Their loss. Also, we wanted to offer a quick trigger warning for this episode. We discussed both sexual assault as well as drug addiction. We understand these topics are sensitive for some, and we want to ensure our listeners are prepared for the content of this show. If you missed your chance last week to play a drinking game to the debate, you can redeem yourself by opening your favorite refreshing beverage, perhaps a margarita, and listening to this episode. Grab your drink and let's get started. Up first, this week's headlines. Last week, Trump tested positive for the coronavirus. I would say that karma is a bitch, but in this case, karma is the coronavirus and Trump is the bitch. I wouldn't even say this is karma, actually. This is just cause and effect. If there's a pandemic and you don't wear a mask, chances are you're gonna catch the virus. For example, if you start painting and you don't wear a jumpsuit, you're gonna get paint on your clothes. Trump is the real-life manifestation of Sideshow Bob stepping on rakes. Except, instead of expressing regret or embarrassment, he turns to his supporters by saying, "This is what a strong leader does." Yeah, a strong leader repeatedly keeps hitting himself in the face with a rake. The thing is, Trump continues to downplay the seriousness of this virus. He did a photo op in front of the White House where he took off his mask to show his supporters how healthy he was. Except then he visibly had trouble breathing. He looked like he was trying to breathe with another Donald Trump sitting on top of him. Don't be surprised if the band Weezer is suddenly labeled political. As of this week, he said that getting the virus was a gift from God. Yeah, absolutely, the same way the people of Egypt received 7 deadly gifts. On Wednesday night, America witnessed the first and only vice presidential debate between Senator Kamala Harris and Vice President Mike Pence. This debate was especially important. With both of the presidential nominees being in their 70s, there was a high likelihood that either VP might have to step into the presidential shoes. If we were to compare this televised event to theater school, I'd say the VPs are kind of like the understudies, and this debate was their put-in rehearsal. They know the lines, the blocking. Heck, they even have fitted costumes. All they're waiting for is that call from the stage manager. Or Congress, if we're sticking with that metaphor. And in turn, the American people are the producers. Only they will decide who gets to perform on opening night. I guess this is what they mean when they say political theater. Furthermore, in terms of style, this debate was much more cordial than the name-calling hysteria we saw last week. Although Pence did try to interrupt his opponent, Harris responded with the now iconic, "Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking." In terms of substance, both Harris and Pence dodged questions about their running mate's age and sidestepped other questions as well. Harris clearly danced around an answer about packing the Supreme Court, and Pence didn't answer questions about pre-existing conditions in the Affordable Care Act, nor did he outright support the peaceful transition of power. Additionally, the moderator, Susan Page, did not ask any follow-up questions. In the end, both candidates echoed a ton of their running mate's previous talking points. But overall, there was a lot of buzz around this debate. It just seemed to fly by. But in the end, we'll just have to wave it off like all the other ones.
And that was this week's headlines.
This week's episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated is brought to us by Theater in the Dark, A War of the Worlds, a virtual audio drama. Link to tickets will be listed in the show notes.
No one would have believed.
You see this? What's happening in the suburbs?
In the first years of the 21st century.
Wi-Fi's not working.
That this world was being watched keenly and closely.
What's happening?
By intelligences greater than our own.
It's in Kankakee. We should drive out and see it.
Careful. Don't get too close.
Dr. Pearson, have there been fresh attempts to signal these beings?
This October.
It's something more than a meteorite.
Theater in the Dark presents...
It's a cylinder.
And it's opening.
A War of the Worlds. A virtual audio drama performed live every night over Zoom. Pay what you can tickets available now at theaterinthedark.com.
Up next, this week's deep dive.
There's been a lot of buzz and excitement and fear and hyperbole surrounding the upcoming election this November. Maybe not endgame level, but definitely Infinity Wars level. As we've addressed in previous episodes on the podcast, both sides of the aisle look at the options for this election as a literal fight against evil. But as I've come to understand, a lot of people's opinions boil down to the perception of a person rather than the actions of the person. For this episode, we wanted to break down the actions versus the words of each candidate. So hopefully you'll have a clear picture of what each candidate stands for. I mean, don't get it twisted. We're going to bash the shit out of Trump. Like, if someone leaves you a piñata and a stick, you're not gonna bash it. But we will also attempt to highlight the things that his supporters seem to point to as accomplishments. And don't worry, we'll do some Biden bashing as well, just to keep things even. With that being said, the focus of our episode today is going to branch into a few sections. 1. Each candidate's campaign platforms. 2. The controversies that the critics continue to point to. And 3. Each candidate's VP choice. Just because everyone is convinced that both of these candidates will end up in assisted living homes before the end of another term. Sounds good then? Well, let's jump right in. So, you want to know about how these two old men would run our country? First, we need to examine their party platforms. And no, we're not talking about the raised dance floor at your favorite discotheque of days of yore. We're talking about the principal goals of the candidates and how they would implement those goals. And we know it's daunting to take time to read through both candidates' platforms. Trust us, we know. In turn, that's why we've created this episode just for you. Now, a quick disclaimer here. Platforms stand for what a party believes in, and they act as a wish list for what a president would hope to achieve. I feel like this is an important reminder because it seems like platforms are used as an excuse as well as a punching bag for both sides. We're not saying that's the wrong thing to do, but just know platforms aren't set in stone. It's more like they're set in Play-Doh. They can stand on their own, but still might need some molding and shaping to become something groundbreaking. And in the end, they still might dry out in the sun. In terms of actual platforms, we're going to be examining Trump and Biden's policies on taxes, COVID-19, and racial equality. Now, there are many more topics we could cover. Things like education, clean energy, the world climate change, the housing market, and international relations. As much as I'd like to talk your ear off, if we went into detail on all of those subjects, this episode would be as long as all the Star Wars movies combined, and that's including The Mandalorian. By the way, I'm looking for safe passage to Tatooine. If anyone has any pertinent info on this matter, they can tweet us at SitStillPodcast. Now, something else I want you to keep in mind. Everything in this political, social, economic, human world is interconnected. Nothing exists in a vacuum. These policies and platforms will affect more than just one part of our society, even if they are siloed under a single issue. With the idea of platforms as wish lists and the interconnection of every issue in mind, let's break down these platforms. The first platform we're going to examine is taxes. They are so confusing and honestly sometimes get a bad rep. Even though we could do a whole episode on the point of taxes, a quick definition reminds us that taxes fund social programs like Social Security, Medicare, local safety net programs, your schools, your roads, as well as aiding your unemployment efforts. Yes, I know it can be so freaking annoying to see 20% of your paycheck lopped off every other week, but you have to remember they serve a bigger purpose. In terms of political candidates, let's look at Biden first. Now, I've been seeing the argument on Facebook that goes something like this. A vote for Biden means your taxes will skyrocket. But does it? Let's break this down. One of Biden's top priorities in terms of taxes will be to repeal the Tax Cuts and Job Acts, individual income tax reductions for Americans earning over $400,000, and restoring the top marginal income tax rate to 39.6% from today's 37%. This means that you only see a significant raise in your taxes if you make over $400,000 a year. And I don't care about you, but I don't fit into that tax bracket, and neither does anyone I personally know. Biden also plans to cap the value of itemized deductions to 28% of those in higher marginal tax brackets. Additionally, he would restore the limitation on itemized deductions for those with taxable incomes above $400,000. Wait, what is this exactly? Well, it means in a taxable year, people with a lot of money can donate their earnings to charities and things like that. Then, when it comes time to do their taxes, the wealthy can write off a number of expenses, like donations, and they won't be taxed for those expenses. What Biden plans to do is cap the percent of what can be written off, and this will apply to those making over $400,000. Along with the capping of the itemized deductions, Biden plans to impose a 12.4% Social Security payroll tax on wage, so like working at a company, and self-employed income earned above $400,000. But what's a payroll tax? Well, it appears on your paychecks and is the money that goes towards Medicare, Social Security, and unemployment insurance. Payroll taxes are one of the largest sources of tax revenue. Switching gears and now talking about big business, Biden would raise the corporate income tax from 21% to 28%. So this would raise the amount of taxable income from businesses. I know this is a lot to take in. Taxes are pretty confusing. But what does this mean for the average American? Well, on average, taxpayers would see a 1.7% decline in after-tax income. So, yes, your taxes will ever go slightly up. But also remember, Biden is doing something to tax the wealthy. It's nothing like Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax, but hey, it's something. Now, over to Trump. Before we get into this, recently, the New York Times revealed that it obtained over two decades of Trump's tax data. Some of the story's biggest findings show that in 2016 and 2017, Trump paid $750 in federal income taxes. And yes, that is a real statistic. That number is so crazy low if Donald Trump is the millionaire that he claims to be. Like, you couldn't even comfortably take a solo trip to Disney World for $750. Also, because of COVID, I haven't gotten to go to Disney World this year, and wow, there is a major hole in my heart. I digress. On top of that, in 10 out of the last 15 years, Trump paid no income taxes at all because he reported that his business lost more money than it made in those years. That's definitely a good sign. So now that it's confirmed that Trump hasn't paid any of his own taxes, let's cross-examine his tax platform. Where should we even start? Well, let's start somewhere easy in that Trump hasn't formally announced one. During the RNC, Trump released a very basic outline of his platforms, and the only ones related to taxes outlined in his agenda were jobs, with bullet points that say, quote, cut taxes to boost take-home pay and keep jobs in America, and Made in America tax credits. And there's no other information about how he would implement or operate these programs. Even the editors of taxfoundation.org, which honestly is a great rec if you're looking to understand taxes in America, they are definitely a friend of the podcast, had difficulty analyzing his second term tax policy platform. All of Trump's ideas were too broad. Honestly, I'm not surprised. So for some quick context, let's check out Trump's 2016 policy reforms. At first glance, Trump's 2016 policies were obviously built to help the wealthy and large corporations. One of Trump's main goals was to lower the corporate income tax rate to 15% and to restructure the corporate income tax base. This corporate tax rate, in turn, would lower federal revenues. Amongst his other plans, Trump organized one of the biggest tax code overhauls in 30 years. Remember the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act from earlier in this episode? You can thank Mr. Trump for his efforts in creating that bill. According to Trump, by cutting both corporate and personal taxes, companies and individuals would have more money to pump into the economy. That's the general idea. But according to the Wall Street Journal, what actually ended up happening was that the rich and wealthy individuals who benefited from the tax cuts didn't circulate any of their excess money back into the economy. In a nutshell, Trump's tax agenda in 2016 implemented a short-term push towards economic growth, but in turn created ongoing increases to federal budget deficits. If you want to read more into this, check out our links in the show notes to taxfoundation.org. They break down step-by-step Trump's tax agenda and its effects. Now, on to one of the most relevant topics of all, the response to COVID-19 and the future of the global health crisis. Let's start with Biden again because, well, even though we'll get into Trump in a few paragraphs, we've already seen his COVID-19 response. Anyway, one of Biden's priorities is to make sure that decisions about our collective public health are made by health professionals and not by greedy politicians. Biden also wants to reinstate the White House National Council Directorate for Global Health and Security and Biodefense. Trump conveniently closed this office in May of 2018 during a reorg of the National Security Council. For a little background, this directorate was in charge of keeping an eye on global health risks, such as, disease outbreaks, and was responsible for organizing the federal government's course of action. This office seems a little pertinent, don't you think? On the ground, Biden wants to make COVID testing easily accessible and free to those who need it, and that applies to those who are uninsured as well. Biden wants to allow the CDC to work with private labs to evaluate the number of tests from thousands to millions. Biden would achieve all of this by amending the Public Health Service Act to cover testing, treatment, and preventative services that are needed to handle a public health emergency. Biden would also amend the Social Security Act so the same requirements are all offered in public health programs. In terms of job loss because of the pandemic, Biden looks to hire displaced workers to create a public health jobs corps. These jobs will coordinate with the federal government to mobilize these corps to work as contact tracers and serve the communities they live in. Biden's COVID-19 response plan also includes offering federal support for childcare and to schools and educators that continue to teach remotely, expanding food relief for families and children that the pandemic has especially hurt, and other federal assistance to hard-hit families. Biden is also looking to the future to create emergency paid sick leave and caregiving leave. That being said, I highly recommend, if anything, reading Biden's COVID-19 response plan. It's excellently laid out and has actual action items. Now, I have no idea if this plan is as far-reaching as it could be, but it's damn well better than what we're faced with right now. And now we get to Mr. Trump's plan, which, honestly, we've been living in it for the last several months. A White House that completely disregards the American people, and one that values money more than a human life. But since we're looking at these plans objectively, let's review Trump's COVID-19 action items. Oh, and by the way, this is coming directly from Trump's RNC press release under the subject line of Eradicate COVID-19. First up, develop a vaccine by the end of 2020, return to normal in 2021, make all critical medicines and supplies for healthcare workers in the United States, and refill stockpiles and prepare for future pandemics. And yep, that's it. And in typical Trump fashion, He listed everything out and gave no explanation. Just like those annoying furniture pieces that you buy on Amazon, and all the directions are for building it is a list of included items and a picture of the end result. Like, what is this? There's no step-by-step at all. So, let's look at those issues here at hand. Up first, develop a vaccine by the end of 2020. This is pretty topical. Basically, Trump wants to have a vaccine before the end of the election so he looks like a hero in stopping COVID. Problem here is that even if a vaccine is developed, it will need to go through months of trials, and then dispersing the vaccine would take months on its own. Return to normal in 2021. I think this is my favorite. It's just so ignorant. And normal for who exactly? Like, with Trump as president, the police will still violently kill and assault people of color, and the working class will cripple from financial hardship. And honestly, for the rich and wealthy, things are normal right now. Next, make all critical medicines and supplies for healthcare workers here in the United States. Okay, this one, sure. It would be great to have PPE made here in the States. But how would these things be made? And would the people working in these factories have proper PPE? What would their working conditions be like? It's these questions that we really need answers to. And finally, refill stockpiles and prepare for future pandemics. First off, why didn't you just prepare us for this pandemic? And refill stockpiles of what? Like, should we all go to the grocery store and buy an extra can of beans and make kind of like an end of the world kit? Like, is that what he's talking about? In short, Trump's COVID-19 response is to basically do nothing. Like, I'm 100% positive it takes Mike and I longer to write these podcast episodes than it did for Trump to create these action items. And the last platform we're going to cover today is racial equality. I mean, this one should be self-explanatory, except for some reason it isn't. To switch it up, let's just take a look at what Trump has been doing so far in the fight for racial justice. In 2020 alone, Trump has gassed protesters in Lafayette Square and sent federal troops to Portland to halt protests against police violence. Even one of his platforms is defend our police, with the top action item being fully fund and hire more police and law enforcement officers. This is exactly the opposite of what needs to happen. What we actually need is stronger, more comprehensive police training, as well as, and probably more importantly, the redistribution of funds to allow for trained healthcare professionals to de-escalate possible mental health situations. It's like someone complaining they can't get a screw out, but they're trying to take it out with a hammer, and Trump's solution is to increase the number of hammers. Okay, I hear this argument a ton, but if there are no police, who will keep us safe? Yes, some law enforcement is necessary, but riddle me this. If you live or grew up in the suburbs, how often did you see police officers roaming around your neighborhood? I can tell you from personal experience, I pretty much never saw them. Not sure if we've said this before on the podcast, but here it is now. Just the existence of excessive police force begets excessive police force. And Trump will do literally anything he can to keep the rich and privileged, quote unquote, safe. In terms of education, Trump's bigotry is so obvious. One of Trump's education goals is to teach American exceptionalism. Now, I know we've touched on this recently, but this is a prime example of thinly veiled racism. Anyone who thinks America is exceptional is willfully ignoring all of the atrocities that occur daily in this country. Trump will stop at nothing to keep oppressing anyone who doesn't look like him. Now, on to Biden. We know that simply voting for Biden will not immediately change the landscape of racial justice. And we're not saying that Biden is the quick fix to racial equality. He's obviously not. But Biden is wildly better than Trump. Like, leaps and bounds better than Trump. First off, let's look at housing in terms of racial equality. One of Biden's priorities is to invest in homeownership and access to affordable housing for Black, Brown, and Native families. It's no secret that COVID-19 has created a huge divide in affordable housing, and the renter crisis is close to imploding because of the pandemic. To combat this, Biden looks to close the inequality in homeownership by designing a new, refundable, advanceable tax credit for first-time homebuyers for up to $15,000. This tax credit incentive will open up the doors for homeownership for so many Americans. On top of that, Biden will push for legislation modeled after California's Homeowners Bill of Rights. For background, it's a set of laws that provide protections to homeowners who are facing foreclosures. A national bill of this classification would ensure that homeowners would have securities in place if and when financial hardship occurs. In the same vein, Biden supports the Legal Assistance to Prevent Evictions Act of 2020, which helps those who have been evicted gain access to legal support and guidance. Although this bill made its debut in February, Biden plans to support and uplift the bill so it can do its work in protecting against evictions. Along with housing, Biden looks to achieve equality in higher education opportunities and therefore create a conduit for steady jobs in the future. According to the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C., Black and Latinx students are 5 times more likely to default on student loans than white students. Additionally, Biden wants to invest $10 billion into historically Black colleges and universities, as well as minority-serving institutions. This aid will go towards increasing enrollment, retention completion, and post-college employment rates. At a glance, these are only a few of Biden's plans to create racial equality in this country. Now, I know we didn't divulge into Biden's policies on police reform, and I totally understand that seems like a missed opportunity, but there's a lot to unpack when it comes to Biden and the police. I will say, though, that if you go to joebiden.com/justice, his reform plans are laid out quite clearly. There is still so much work that needs to be done about the police force. And we know that simply electing Biden won't change the status quo immediately, but it is so much more helpful than the prospects of another 4 years with Mr. Trump. In a perfect world, American voters would vote for the candidate of their choice based off their policies and their platforms. Unfortunately, though, I have noticed that many people disregard policy altogether and tend to vote on gut feeling or things that they hear X candidate has done in the past. Increasing awareness of this being a factor has just led to a fraction of the distrust in the media, you know, for promoting scandals as prime stories. But then again, news outlets respond to their data, and their data points to people being drawn to scandals. So maybe don't get so outraged when you keep saying how great capitalism is if you don't like its products. Nonetheless, we figured we would look into these scandals from each side to see if any of these Facebook outrage memes hold any water, and so you can get a clearer picture on how much moral and ethical values matter to you before you cast your vote. Let's start with Biden. Republican voters would have you believe that Joe Biden is the most scandal-ridden presidential candidate in the history of politics. While the projection with them is unyielding, my research into Biden's scandals are enough to remind me why I was unenthusiastic about him in the first place. The plus side being, I thought there would be so many more. When you search for the scandals about Biden in Google, the first results that pop up are surprisingly not conspiracy forums from QAnon, but news articles from his presidential bid in the 1980s. In 1988, Joe Biden ended his 3-month presidential campaign when he spouted several quotes from British Labour Party leader Nick Kinnock as his own. The plagiarism reinforced criticism at the time, saying that Biden was a candidate of style, not of substance. Which is actually a critique that I would say still holds true today. It actually makes me wonder how we got into this state, where we're looking at an election of two candidates in which style over substance is the defining trait. I would gander to guess it reflects poorly on the state of our voters in this country. But still, the allegations of Biden's plagiarism led to the unsurfacing of more plagiarism from as far back as his college days, when Biden failed a course because he wrote a paper that used 5 pages from a published law review article without any quotation marks or proper footnote. Once again, this scandal ended his presidential bid. Thank God Melania wasn't running for president in 2016 or she would have been screwed. Biden has also received critical remarks for his writing that wasn't plagiarized. A big area of judgment for Biden recently has been his role in helping to write the 94 crime bill, which many believe led to the increase of mass incarceration, specifically affecting Black and brown people. To break it down, the 94 crime bill was introduced under President Bill Clinton's administration in response to the record numbers in rising crime. Violent crime, I should say. It did this by instituting tougher prison sentences at the federal level. An article written by Vox described the bill by saying, it provided funds for states to build more prisons, aimed to fund 100,000 more cops and backed grant programs that encouraged police officers to carry out more drug-related arrests, an escalation of the war on drugs. The move itself was considered mostly politically motivated as a chance for Democrats to prove to voters that they were making crime a Democratic issue. The hope was to lure more conservative and moderate voters through legislation. Biden used the bill to brag that the liberal wing of the Democratic Party was now for 60 new death penalties, 70 enhanced penalties, 100,000 cops, and 125,000 new state prison cells. While it would seem logical to deduce that this is a clear correlation to the rise of mass incarcerations, the facts behind that don't totally really stand up. The majority of incarcerations were all seen at the state level. The bill only affected change on the federal level, something Biden continues to point to as a defense of the bill he passed. So technically, Biden is correct, as the 94 bill did not directly influence the rate of incarcerations in the U.S., but it's hard not to see how an argument could be made to say that it indirectly did. Sort of like monkey see, monkey do. Only in this context, it's monkey see, monkey incarcerate. And although many people now look at the 94 crime bill as a strike against Biden, it's also the bill that is responsible for the Violence Against Women's Act and the assault rifle ban, both of which were provisions included within the bill. At the time, the bill was widely bipartisan, with Democrats praising the Violence Against Women Act and the assault rifle provisions, while criticizing things like three strikes provisions, whereas Republicans more or less did the opposite. In fact, revisions to the bill actually caused Republicans like Mitch McConnell to vote against it, stating that the bill wasn't strong enough, calling the bill quote-unquote pork. Which, what? That seems like an odd insult to me. I would never call Mitch McConnell pork. I have too much respect for bacon. Nonetheless, what this bill essentially boils down to is this. The bill was a political move aimed at being a bipartisan attempt to tackle a rising issue in America in the early 1990s. In typical political fashion, both sides voted for it, with many members being vocal of its issues, but praising the broad strokes of the good it set out to accomplish. All in all, there's a large mixed bag in terms of good and bad stuff here. And if you really want to get a better picture on if Biden is in the right for defending it, then you'll have to do some more digging and deciding for yourself. The next biggest scandal for Joe Biden isn't really even about him. It's actually about his son, Hunter Biden, a scandal that may suddenly be flooding your memory again, as he was a major Republican scapegoat during Trump's impeachment hearings, as well as mentioned in the last debate. In 2014, after the Ukrainian Revolution, Hunter Biden served on the board of a Ukrainian gas company, a Ukrainian gas company that was implicated in a money laundering scheme. While serving on the board, it appears that there was no evidence that Hunter Biden was involved or knew about any of the dealings. How does this tie into Trump's impeachment? Well, according to Reuters, Trump was impeached on charges of abuse of power and obstruction in the Democratic-led House of Representatives after he asked Ukraine to investigate the Bidens. Despite the continued Republican probe into Hunter Biden's role in Ukraine, he has been repeatedly cleared of any wrongdoings by numerous officials and investigators into the subject. On a more personal note, Hunter Biden allegedly fathered an illegitimate child while dating the widowed wife of his dead brother. He's also struggled with substance abuse. Joe Biden has publicly said how proud he is of his son's recovery. Basically, a big point of contention against Biden has simply been pointing the finger at the shortcomings of his son. It wasn't enough to stop George H.W. Bush from getting elected, but these are different times and controversies aren't what they used to be. However, I would say there's actually a fairly big controversy that does actually plague Biden, and that is the accusation of sexual assault. Earlier this year, Tara Reid stepped forward and accused Joe Biden of sexually assaulting her 27 years ago. Biden has categorically denied this event from happening, and Tara Reid has been unable to provide any evidence or credible witness to attempt to her account. But there have been many accounts documenting Biden's lack of boundaries and inappropriate touching. Supporters of Biden have pointed that the timing of her accusation brings up the question of whether she is fabricating a story to create a controversy, or if she's actually telling the truth. And while a false accusation of sexual assault can destroy someone's life, if we've learned anything in the last 4 years, it is that it's hard to come forward about these things. And sexual assault has already destroyed the lives of millions of women. Nonetheless, I'm inclined to believe Mrs. Reid. And the idea of throwing my support behind someone who would be capable of doing such an action angers and sickens me. especially when we had such a wide and diverse field of candidates who would have chosen to respect the Democratic Party. But I guess America isn't quite ready to release its deepest ingrained misogyny. Baby steps. I would like to point out that another controversy about Joe Biden is quickly gaining steam in the vast corners of the internet. And that is the accusation of Joe Biden being a pedophile. This claim has been proved to be 100% false. According to PolitiFact, a fact-checking website, there is no credible evidence that supports this claim. In Joe Biden's more than 40 years of public life, we could find no news reports, formal accusations, complaints, arrests, or investigations that implicate him in any sort of sex crimes involving kids. The idea of Joe Biden being a pedophile is a direct result of a QAnon conspiracy that suggests a deep state is working against President Trump's success. And while the theory is baseless and lacks credibility, it's gained momentum due to publicity and attention Donald Trump has given to it, stoking the fire of his supporters, specifically the far right, who are inclined to take things at face value if they feel it aligns with their ideals. But now we move on to Trump. Okay, so after doing some light Googling, I have already predetermined that it would take way too long to go through all of Trump's scandals. One website, McSweeney.net, has documented over 889 controversies, and that was on September 3rd. I have no doubt we are set to break through 900 by the time the list is updated. Now, I do feel it's fair to mention that McSweeney's is a satire site, but after reading through the list, I can think the joke here is that they just keep listing things that actually happened. What else can you write about when the truth is stranger than fiction, right? Anyway, for the sake of expediency, I think it's best to split up Trump controversies into categories. They will be listed as such. Sexual harassment or harassment in general, Russia/obstruction of justice, indictments of Trump's administration officials, Trump family business dealings/fraud. I think it bears mentioning that Trump already has more controversies listed by category than Biden does altogether. Let's start with sexual harassment. As of now, 26 women have come forward with claims of sexual harassment. These claims range from walking into the changing rooms of pageant contestants to much scarier, more serious accusations of rape. Several of these accusations have come from underage women. At least four women have reiterated the same story of Trump walking into the changing rooms of the Teen Miss USA pageant when contestants were not fully clothed. One lawsuit that was filed in 2016 explicitly says that Trump raped a girl when she was 13 years old. Several of these claims were indirectly corroborated by Trump's own words. In 2005, Trump was recorded on the Howard Stern show talking about abusing his status in the pageants by saying,
So you have done that. Now,
I'll tell you the funniest is that I'll go backstage before a show.
Yes.
And everyone's getting dressed and ready and everything else. And, you know, no men are anywhere. And I'm allowed to go in because I'm the owner of the pageant, and therefore I'm inspecting it. You know, I'm inspecting.
Right,
I want to make sure that
you're like
everything
a doctor.
Is good.
You're there.
Yeah, the dress. Is everyone okay? You know, they're standing there with no clothes. Is everybody okay? And you see these incredible-looking women. And so I sort of get away with things like that.
His behavior was further cemented when the infamous Access Hollywood tape, where he bragged about grabbing women by the you-know-what. His close connections to Jeffrey Epstein have strengthened links to the accusations of pedophilia. Jeffrey Epstein was a confirmed convicted underage sex trafficker. In 2002, Trump was quoted as saying, "I've known Jeff for 15 years. Terrific guy. He's a lot of fun to be with. It is even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side, no doubt about it. Jeffrey enjoys his social life." Leading many to believe that Trump was very aware of Epstein's pedophile ring. While it seems like there is a mountain of evidence that all points to an established history of behavior, it's all circumstantial, and Trump has denied all claims against him. The Founding Fathers feared that abuse of power would be taken if the president used his office to promote legislation that promoted them individually over the country. So they instituted an anti-corruption provision into the Constitution called the Emoluments Clause. It's sort of like the Santa Clause with Tim Allen, except instead of becoming Santa by accidentally killing him, it prohibits the president from receiving any profit, gain, or advantage from any foreign or domestic government. How's that for a logline? You may have heard of this because there has been an outrage over Trump's refusal to adhere to it since before he even took office. As the American Constitution Society puts it, President Donald Trump has been violating the Constitution since noon on January 20th, 2017. How, may you ask? Well, as Shakespeare once said, let me count the ways. Upon winning the election, Trump refused to divest from his companies and place his assets in a blind trust. This led to Ivanka accompanying Trump on a 60 Minutes interview to promote her jewelry line, promoting Melania's biography and jewelry line on the White House website, 100 foreign diplomats booking rooms in Trump hotels. He claimed that he donated the proceeds to the government, although no evidence of that has ever been provided. Doubling the initiation fee at Mar-a-Lago to $200,000, the U.S. military renting out space in Trump Tower for $2.4 million a year, the Secret Service spending $3 million for every trip to Mar-a-Lago, at least $137,000 on golf cart rentals per trip. And that's just to name a few. Outside emoluments, Trump has also employed nepotism by hiring both his daughter and son-in-law to work on classified information, despite not being cleared by government officials. Prior to Trump's presidency, he was a big fan of engaging in activities such as fraud and money laundering. Like in 2016, Trump agreed to pay $25 million to settle his Trump University fraud lawsuits, even though he stated that he wouldn't settle. The real estate seminar program was not an accredited university and used misleading marketing tactics to recruit students. Or when Trump's campaign was also found to have illegally used money to fund his campaign that was originally raised for veterans. It is only after they were caught that a judge ordered Trump's campaign to redirect the money to vets. Or even when Trump's Taj Mahal was fined $10 million for money laundering, something that is easy to catch when a casino files for bankruptcy three times. This is the successful businessman you elected, America. I'm not exactly sure if Trump's recently released tax records showing him paying less taxes than immigrants is fraud or not, but Trump's recently released tax records show that he paid less in taxes than immigrants. So I'll just leave that there for you. Like, just look at his members of his staff/administration. In just 4 years, 8 Trump staffers have been arrested or convicted of crimes. Even if we were looking at it from a non-illegal standpoint, the administration has had 56 staffers either fired, quit, or pressured to leave. Brookings at EDU put the turnover rate at 95% from when he first entered the White House. Ugh, yikes. Coming from someone who's worked in the service industry, if there's a high turnover rate, you know management is bad news. And then, of course, there's the Russia investigation. He got impeached. End of story. You want more facts? Google it. This episode is already 3 hours long. All in all, I would say that both presidential candidates have controversies. And there are going to be many voters who disregard platforms altogether and will vote purely off of smear campaigns. Heck, there are going to be people who are going to believe conspiracy theories circling around on QAnon or wherever the liberal equivalent of QAnon is. I guess, as always, the point is, feel free to do your own research. But you can use this episode as your diving board into it. Splash! The last important aspect of both of these presidential candidates are their vice presidential candidate picks. And if you're like me, you're probably wondering what the point of a VP in an election even is. From what I know on the surface, they campaign around with the presidential candidates and smile and wave. But it's so much more, isn't it? One of the biggest jobs of a VP is being the second in command if anything is to happen to the sitting president. That's a pretty obvious one. And it's happened before. Here's a quick fact, but I don't know how fun it is, though. When Lincoln was assassinated, Johnson became president. And almost 100 years later, when Kennedy was assassinated, Johnson became president. And 40 years from now, don't be surprised if there's another Johnson becoming president. Too dark? Meh. Even though we're hoping no presidents get assassinated, in this current election, the question of age and health are so obvious. This has become a big debating point. Even former President Jimmy Carter is known for saying he wouldn't have felt confident doing the job at age 80. In the same vein, both Biden and Trump have accused each other of being unfit for the job due to health problems. So in this election, VPs might play a more important role than ever, seeing as they may have to swoop in the final hour. I'm not saying that will happen, but who knows? Now, historically, most voters don't explicitly change their votes due to a candidate's VP pick. But it's known that voters can change their biases or perceptions of a presidential candidate due to their VP selections. Speaking of which, let's talk about Kamala Harris. If you were keeping up with Biden's VP selection process, You know that it was tumultuous, to say the least. But through all the kerfuffle, Kamala Harris arose as Biden's running mate. Harris comes from the law enforcement background. A native of Oakland, California, she served as the San Francisco District Attorney from 2004 to 2011, and as California's Attorney General from 2011 to 2017, until she was elected to the Senate in 2016. But most of us know Kamala Harris from her run for Democratic presidential nominee in 2019. Although she was an early frontrunner, she dropped out prematurely due to her depleted campaign funds. If you watched any of the Democratic nominee debates, you'd probably remember Harris's jabs at her now running mate over policies that he implemented that directly affected her. In terms of policy, Harris describes herself as a pragmatist rather than a hardline progressive, and believes that change can be most effective from working inside the system. Hey, they're not our words, they're hers. Now, Harris has her own controversial history as well. Some of her criticisms date back to when she was a defense attorney. She held weak positions on prosecuting police officers, and in one case, refused to allow DNA testing for a black man on death row, the evidence which may have resulted in his exoneration. Although this is a big deterrent for supporters of police reform, which should be everyone but somehow isn't, these criticisms can be noted as strengths for more centrist or conservative swing voters. Even though Harris has a pragmatist approach, she was rated by GovTrack.org to be the most liberal voting member of the Senate in 2019 due to her voting record. Which, I mean, probably isn't hard seeing as the Senate is absolutely controlled by conservatives. Regardless, her voting records track with Joe Biden's seemingly progressive platforms. One last stat for you all about Harris. According to ABC/YouGov polling, Kamala Harris enjoys a 54 out of 29 favorability rating. And Langer Research, the group that conducts all the research, states that 1 in 4 Republicans approve of Harris's selection as VP. Now, we know that doesn't bode well for creating big systemic change. But at least Harris and Biden have a platform to somehow help the American people. Have you heard that nursery rhyme? Sing a song of sixpence, a pocket full of rye, 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie. I have not taken the time to break down what that means, but we're not doing the sixpence. Today, we're just doing the 1 pence. Mike Pence, that is. After reading a brief history of Mike Pence, it would seem that Pence has had a checkered past. According to ProPublica.org, Pence actually started his career as a Democrat and kept a clipping of JFK as a boy. This didn't last long, though, as he quickly shifted to Republican views after college, prompting the question of if his clippings of JFK were the sign of fandom or the preparation for a career as a serial killer. The answer is still unclear. Nonetheless, since the transition, Pence has described himself as a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order. Something that has been very clear when you look at the motivations behind the actions he's taken. While he always wanted to get into politics, he lost the first 2 elections he ran for. His second campaign in 1990 was shrouded in controversy, doing things like using campaign funds to pay for his car and golfing outings, as well as running an ugly smear campaign associated with his running mate with Arabic stereotypes thanking the politician for oil support. However, 1 year later, Pence wrote an essay called Confessions of a Negative Campaigner and apologized for his actions. It was an essay he used to rebrand his image. After his failed stint into politics, Pence hosted a political radio show for nearly 10 years in Indianapolis before regaining the nerve to run again, this time winning the seat in the Senate. If anything, it is clear that Pence has stuck to his guns when it comes to his views on small government and budget spending. He opposed President Bush's No Child Left Behind program. He opposed Bush's Medicare Part D, which subsidized seniors' prescription drugs. And he vehemently opposed the 2008 bailout. One of the pitfalls of his career in the Senate was perhaps the legislation he introduced on broader security requiring illegal immigrants to self-deport themselves in order to reapply to come back into the country. Believe it or not, this received, as ProPublica called it, scorn from the right, as he lost support from his base. Despite his views on immigration, one of the things that appears to be most shocking in today's climate is his continued backing for protections of the free press. The only thing that would be more refreshing than that tidbit would be an ice-cold Fresca. The rest of his career in the Senate was spent as the Republican conference chairman. He contemplated running for president in 2012, but ultimately decided to run for governor of Indiana instead. And this is where he starts to sound a little more familiar. It was during his tenure as governor that his career-defining decisions were made, doing things like instituting Indiana's largest tax cut ever seen and putting in place incredibly strict abortion laws. This included cutting into the funding for Planned Parenthood. But perhaps his most famous move was helping pass the 2015 Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This act expanded protections on religious liberty and essentially gave businesses the right to deny anyone service to LGBTQIA+ people. The move was so wildly hated that multiple high-level corporations such as Angie's List, Yelp, Apple, and the NCAA all pulled their businesses from the state and issued public criticisms of the law, costing Indiana millions of dollars and thousands of jobs. Pence quickly tried to amend the law, but to no satisfaction of any of his critics. It also seems as if he had not learned his lesson in 1990 when he received similar criticism for comparing Obama's Healthcare Act to 9/11. Prior to his VP nomination, he called Trump's views on Muslim bans offensive and unconstitutional and supported Ted Cruz until the senator dropped out. Pence was also looking at a tough re-election and likely about to lose until Trump swooped in and offered him the VP nomination. Other notable highlights of Pence's career. He has led the White House task force on the coronavirus response, criticized for reacting too slowly. He has supported funding for conversion therapy when it came to homosexual behavior, criticized as being ignorant and archaic. He continues to call his wife mother, criticized for being creepy and weird. Overall, I would say the serial killer vibe is still on the table and would caution you to dismiss the idea without concrete evidence that he is, in fact, not building the resume of a serial killer. So, we've reached the point in our episode for our age-old question, why does this matter? Honestly, this episode speaks for itself. All of the topics we covered just go to show that something must be done to protect our basic human rights. Hopefully now, you have a slightly better picture of each candidate's platforms, ethical outlook, and background for each of their assisted living nurses. So, use this information as you will. Don't forget that this entire episode has only covered the presidential candidates. As we've all learned during the pandemic, down-ticket candidates have just as a large impact on your life, if not more so, than national offices. While it's important to understand the standard bearer's positions, we strongly recommend looking at your sample ballot beforehand and doing cursory research on those people seeking to represent you on the state and municipal level. Ballotopedia has an excellent sample ballot lookup to be able to learn more about the candidates and measures that you'll be asked to vote on. And finally, we've said it loud and we've said it clear before on this show, but just in case you forgot, grab your margarita and go vote! Woo! Today's show. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at @sitstill_lookopinionated and on Twitter at @sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. See you next week. Bye.